Yesterday, October 24th, 2015, was the 70th anniversary of the start of the United Nations. The United States did not join the League of Nations after World War I, even though it was the idea of U.S. President Woodrow Wilson. But Wilson couldn't get the two-thirds vote needed in the U.S. Senate to ratify the Versailles Treaty, which included the covenant of the League of Nations. Because of what happened at the end of World War I, President Roosevelt wanted to get the United Nations created and the U.S. committed to it before World War II ended. And he succeeded in doing that. But the UN Charter, created at the end of May 1945, didn't get the needed ratifications from other countries until October 24th. So that is the day when the UN Charter went into effect 70 years ago. From a longer perspective, both the League of Nations and the United Nations were the first international organizations to deal generally with all international problems. The first international organizations in the 19th century dealt with particular international problems like navigation on rivers. Now, in the 21st century, humanity is transitioning from an international world to a single planetary community. A very significant issue is whether the International Confederal United Nations can be transformed into a democratic federal government which can deal more effectively with the problems facing our global community, such as global warming and the danger of nuclear war. At this critical time in the long history of humanity, it is important for everyone to know what the UN is, what its limitations are, and how it might be able to deal with the problems confronting us. So, what is the nature of the United Nations? The United Nations is only an association of national governments, by national governments, for national governments. The national governments of many nations would like to have more influence at the UN than they have. But in fact, the UN is basically controlled by the big countries and especially by the United States. The UN definitely is not a world government. The UN can't make laws, it can't collect taxes, and it has no military forces or equipment of any kind, no black helicopters or anything else like that. The UN peacekeeping forces are, in fact, only the national military forces of certain countries, such as Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Fiji, which make money by having their troops serve as UN peacekeepers because they pay their troops less than the UN pays them, a certain amount per day per troop, and they don't pay their troops that much. The UN idea was started by the United States and Britain in 1942, at the beginning of World War II. UN headquarters is now located in New York City, and English is the most used language, though on paper there are six official languages at the UN. The United States pays 22% of the UN budget, and that is equal to our proportion of the world's economy, even though we only have 4.5% of the world's people. And we also pay 27% of the UN peacekeeping budget, which is separate. The regular UN budget is only $2.7 billion a year, one-tenth of the budget of the state of Missouri. The UN peacekeeping budget is $8.3 billion a year, equal to only 1.3% of the U.S. military budget of $610 billion. So the UN is a great deal for us in terms of having forces do the peacekeeping without having to pay our forces. There were only 51 countries in the UN at the beginning in 1945, but now there are 193 countries. The growth of numbers is mainly because former European colonies in Africa and Asia became independent countries and then members of the UN, a change which was supported by both the Soviets and the United States. So it's one of the few things that could be done during the Cold War. Some incidents will show how completely the United States dominates the United Nations. Consider this. The communists took control of mainland China in 1949. But were not allowed to choose the UN representatives of China until 1971, 22 years later. Another event was at the end of 1996, when the United States, all alone, without any other country supporting us, kept Boutros-Ghali from getting reelected as UN Secretary General. And then we arranged for Kofi Annan to get the job. U.S. control of the UN. The two policy-making bodies of the UN in New York are the General Assembly and the Security Council. But they are very different in their power and their membership. In the General Assembly, every country that is a member of the UN is entitled to one vote, regardless of its wealth and population. Members include some mini-states, islands in the Pacific, with populations less than the population of the St. Louis metropolitan area. The General Assembly runs the United Nations organization what goes on in the organization itself, such as setting the budget. But beyond that, the General Assembly can only make recommendations. It can't make laws, it can't collect taxes, and all the money comes from the contributions of national governments, either on the basis of what they're allocated to give, or some free will voluntary contributions, but there's no other source of money for the UN. The Security Council is the locus of the real power at the UN. Theoretically, every member of the United Nations is obliged to abide by the resolutions adopted by the Security Council. So in a sense, the Security Council can make international law. And the Security Council is composed of representatives of 15 countries. Five of these countries are the big countries on the winning side in World War II. Remember, it started before the war ended. Namely, the United States, Britain, that is the United Kingdom, Russia, France, and China. Each of these five permanent members of the Security Council has a veto power. A veto stops a resolution from being adopted, even if all the other 14 countries favor it. That means the UN Security Council can't do anything that the United States doesn't want it to do, that Russia doesn't want it to do, and so on. The other 10 nations on the Security Council are elected by the General Assembly for two-year terms, 5 of them each year. The Big Five's veto power has kept the Security Council from doing very much during the Cold War, when you had Russia and the United States on opposing sides, and also even now cannot do very much that might restrain those 5 big powers or their allies, like Israel or Syria. The Big Five's veto power can also be used to stop all efforts to amend the UN Charter, which is why it doesn't get amended. The third main body of the UN is the Economic and Social Council, which consists of representatives from 54 countries and is responsible for the coordination of the economic, social, and related work of the 14 United Nations specialized agencies, its functional committees, and the 5 regional commissions. The Economic and Social Council is in charge of much of the United Nations humanitarian and human rights activities, that which I think is generally most popular that the UN does. The top UN administrator is the Secretary General, whose term of office is 5 years. Ban Ki-moon of South Korea became the Secretary General in January 2007. His second term, and that is the usual rule, the Secretary General usually serves for 2 terms. The second term ends in December 2016. There is currently pressure at the United Nations that the next Secretary General should be a woman. And I think that's likely to happen. Another important international institution, not the United Nations, but another institution, is the International Court of Justice, also formed after World War II, and it's located in The Hague in the Netherlands. It deals only with legal disputes between national governments, and only if they agree in advance that they're going to abide by the judgment. So very often, cases that should come up do not come up. The UN system includes 18, the UN system, not just the UN organization, the UN system includes 18 other international organizations, such as the World Health Organization, the Universal Postal Union, the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization called UNESCO, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank Group, 5 banking organizations, which includes the International Finance Corporation. If the United Nations were to become a government, then these other international organizations would become the departments of that government, just like in the United States, we have the various departments. So what are the accomplishments of the UN? What has it done? Its main job is to keep the peace. The UN strategy for stopping aggression by any country is called collective security. If the Security Council adopts a resolution identifying a country as an aggressor, all the member states are supposed to make their military forces available to fight against that aggressor nation. This has happened twice. The first time the Security Council did this was in 1950, when communist North Korea attacked non-communist South Korea. The result was the 3-year Korean War. The UN's military forces under US General Douglas MacArthur eventually succeeded in stopping the attempted takeover of South Korea by the North Korean communists. As is evident from the news today, that UN success in halting aggression was very important, especially for the people of South Korea. Many of the leaders at the UN, like Ban Ki-moon, are from South Korea. The second time the Security Council acted to stop aggression was in 1991, when Iraq's Saddam Hussein tried to take over UN member state Kuwait for its oil. The Security Council's authorization of this first Gulf War was possible because the Soviet Union was no longer using its veto so that the Security Council could take action. And this war was won, this first Gulf War was won by a coalition coordinated by the United States under the first President Bush. So that was the second time that the UN had succeeded in stopping aggression. At the end of 2002 and the beginning of 2003, the United States tried to get the UN Security Council to approve another military action against Iraq on grounds that Saddam Hussein still had weapons of mass destruction. The Chinese, French, and Russians were not persuaded. When the U.S. forces nevertheless attacked Iraq, it was viewed as without UN Security Council authorization. Thus, under international law, this military attack, the second Gulf War, led by the U.S., constituted international aggression. The United States was guilty of leading aggression against another member state. But nobody was able to do anything because of U.S. Security Council veto power. A month after 9/11, the U.S. did get authorization by the UN Security Council to get Afghanistan to stop the Taliban from providing a place for terrorist training. So we did get UN Security Council support at that time. And that resolution also authorized getting Osama bin Laden taken over and turned over to national authorities who could prosecute him. So the action against Osama bin Laden was authorized by the UN Security Council. One of the big successes of the UN as a factor in preventing war was its role in the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962. Many of us lived through that, remembering the 13 days when the whole world held its breath to see if there would be a nuclear holocaust and maybe the end of everything. The defusing of the situation occurred in private talks, but also in the public appeals to world public opinion that were being made at the United Nations. So the United Nations became a forum for discussion of this incident. Going back to 1948, since 1948, the UN Security Council has been sending in peacekeeping forces to oversee peace agreements in tense areas. After there's a peace agreement, then the UN peacekeeping forces go in. There are now in the world 16 such missions. 9 of them are in Africa. And here in the United States, we don't get much news about that, but nevertheless, it's an important thing that's happening. Also, the UN has been much more successful in nation building than the United States has. The UN efforts, successful efforts include Namibia in 1989-90, El Salvador in 1991-95, Cambodia, 1992-93, Mozambique, 1992-94, the East Slavonian region of Croatia, 1996-1998, and East Timor in 1999-2005. So that's really quite a record that the UN has of being able to bring about the peaceful settlement of disputes within countries. Since the 1970s, the UN General Assembly has also been instrumental in promoting international conferences and treaties concerning arms control, the rights of women and children, preserving the environment, the issue of AIDS, the controlling of the spread of contagious diseases, the addressing of population growth, considering the human rights of refugees and minorities, and establishing governance of the oceans and outer space. There's a UN law of the sea that has in fact gone into effect. There's a oceans regime governed by the UN, which is in effect. And the UN has also been involved in addressing other global problems. There's going to be another conference in December about global warming. In 1998, the UN General Assembly convened a conference in Rome, which approved a treaty to create a permanent international criminal court, or the ICC. It can prosecute individuals. This is one of the greatest changes in international law ever. Up until then, only nations could be held accountable. People who have been indicted are still not getting arrested. There's no U.S. support for that. In September of 2005, another important event, the UN General Assembly convened a world summit that brought together the heads of most member states. It approved the World Summit Outcome Document. Kofi Annan was one of the main leaders behind this effort. One of the most important agreements was to commit billions of dollars to achieving the Millennium Development Goals. The 8 Millennium Development Goals are to eradicate extreme poverty and hunger, achieve universal primary education, promote gender equality and empower women, reduce the child mortality rate, improve maternal health, combat HIV, AIDS, malaria, and other diseases, ensure environmental sustainability, and develop a global partnership for development. The principle of the Millennium Development Goals is that the richer countries have an obligation to help poorer countries deal with these difficult problems. And in fact, the Millennium Development Goals have been like two-thirds achieved, which is a really great accomplishment, especially in the eyes of the people in the poorer countries. It is the case that now there's going to be 17 new sustainable goals being set up at the end of this year for the future to give the UN some ideas about what things, give the national governments some things that they should be working on. Another part of that 2005 World Summit outcome document was the unanimous agreement that individual nations have the responsibility to protect, abbreviated R2P, the responsibility to protect everyone within their borders from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. And furthermore, that the international community is able to act collectively to protect vulnerable citizens if some country fails to fulfill its responsibility. This is an explicit rejection of the traditional international law view that a national government could do whatever it wanted to do without limitation within its borders. The Nuremberg trials and the Tokyo trials after World War II were the beginning of this movement getting it so national governments can't do anything they want to do within their own borders. During the next few years, the UN has become, during the past few years, the UN has become the coordinator and cheerleader for getting the world to help the neediest anywhere and everywhere. You've probably heard about the refugees in Europe. The UN is coordinating as well as the European Union. All over the world, the presence of UN personnel means that help is on the way for needy people. The UN gets its money from national governments and then pays national government, non-governmental organizations to actually do the work. When disaster strikes, poor countries and people, such as refugees, can look to the UN to coordinate relief efforts. There are some other things the UN does that we don't hear much about. The UN system provides for the continuous collection and publication of information necessary to understand the state of the world as a whole and of the different countries in the world. The existence of the UN also means that each September, when the General Assembly convenes, leaders and policymakers of the various countries of the world all get a chance to talk with each other informally without needing to travel long distances, something which is especially helpful for the smaller, poorer countries of the world and which also enables people from the bigger countries, the diplomats, to get together without the media noticing too much what they're doing. And a lot of diplomacy takes place at that time. Now, what is the role of the non-governmental organizations, or what's also called the civil society organizations? The UN is coming to realize that they are an important part of global governance. In trying to deal with global problems, the United Nations gets important assistance from these non-governmental organizations, like the Red Cross, like Doctors Without Borders, Amnesty International, and so on. The UN General Assembly has now been taking measures to get more input from these non-governmental organizations in its deliberations. One non-governmental organization working to support the UN is our own UN office, located in New York, very close to the United Nations. Its executive director, Bruce Knotts, served in the United States State Department in its Foreign Service Department for 23 years. He believes that the UN has been portrayed in the United States as an ineffective organization. He says that is not the perception of the UN in most of the rest of the world. He says, part of what I want you used to know is that the UN is an important and effective organization for peace and development and humanitarian aid. Knotts' respect for the UN is based on his own experience. Quote, I think the UN operation in Sierra Leone was one of the most successful it ever had. When I first went there in 2000, 95% of the country was held by rebels. The UN played a huge role in Sierra Leone in creating the conditions for peace and then rebuilding the country when the war was over. End of quote. The UN has played a critical role, and the UN office has played a major role in generating international support for gender rights. That was an effort of our UN office that got international support just during this last year. Now, I happen to be the UN envoy for this congregation. That is, I have a responsibility from the UN office. This is why you see this literature that's on the pews. I invite you to take it with you. And there are many of them, and they're not all the same. They're about different programs that the UN office is carrying out. As an envoy, my job is to get more of you to join as individuals to support the UUUN office. Just go to the website of UUUNO and indicate you would like to join, and you will become a member. I'm also supposed to get this congregation to become a congregational member of the UUUN office. That requires a $100 contribution each year, and I hope that I am going to be able to get this congregation to do that. So please read this literature and find out more about what is being done by our UUUN office with regard to programs for children, for women, for racial minorities, gender rights, and so on. They're not all the same, so pick up more than one. I think there's six different kinds. The future of the UN. One of the biggest factors in the future of the UN is the support that it gets or doesn't get from the United States. That's critical. History shows that the UN thrives when the US supports it and goes downhill when the U.S. does not support it. A big obstacle for us in this country is a well-funded small group of Americans who oppose the United Nations and anything international. And that's one of our main opponents for our UUUN office. We need to get publicity out on what the UN is successfully doing and why we need to support it. A promising development for the future of the UN is a just released report, the report of the Commission on Global Security, Justice, and Governance, co-chaired by former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and former Nigerian Foreign Minister Ibrahim Gambari. Its report, called Confronting the Crisis of Global Governance, sets forth many proposals for making the global community more secure, more just, and better governed, including the need to create a UN Rapid Response Force and a UN Parliamentary Network that would be more like something you have in the European Union, with the European Parliament, and finally, a holding of a World Conference on Global Institutions in 2020. Now, this report is not an official UN document. It's a couple of agencies that are interested in international problems and getting themselves, but they're working now to get the UN to decide to have a conference for global governance in 2020. Some way has got to be found to make the UN more effective than it has been in dealing with global problems, whether we change or don't change the UN Charter. Otherwise, the global community is going to need to find some other more effective global organization. It would be a crime if we lose the UN, but that could happen, and part of the problem is what our own government doesn't do. Obama has been a big supporter, but he can't do much without the support of Congress, and he doesn't get it. Thank you very much.